Welcome to this special edition of the Washington AI Network podcast. Yes, yes. Thank you all for coming. We're here at the House at 1229, and today, a very important event. We'll examine healthcare innovations in the age of AI. My guests today are two Washington area tech legends, Ted Leonsis and Grant Verstandig. Aren't we so lucky they're here? Ted truly needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. He is the former president of America Online. Remember them? Who is on America Online? Who is still on America Online? Okay. If you were not on there, they were the company that made the internet part of everyday life for all of us, a true tech pioneer. He is also the founder and chairman and CEO of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, which owns the 2018 Stanley Cup champion Washington Capitals. Woo! How great. Actually, Ted was reminding me the Veep cast, when they were shooting here, every night they would come to the games, had such a great time. The NBA's Washington Wizards, let's hear it for the Wizards. And the WNBA's 2019 champion Washington Mystics. Go Mystics! Okay. He is founder and partner at Revolution, a leading DC-based investment firm, along with our friend Steve Case. Thank you so much for being here. And you guys know Revolution's late-stage fund is an investor in Zephyr AI. We're going to talk about it today. A company reshaping precision medicine for cancer and diabetes patients. Thank you again, Ted, for coming. Okay. And next to him is Grant Verstandig. In high school, Grant was an AI research fellow at NIH. I don't know how you got that.
Me either.
And later, the National Cancer Institute. In 2010, he founded Rally Health, a consumer-centric digital health company, which was acquired by United Health in 2017 to much buzz and hopefully a lot of money. Let's hope. Today, he's the founder, chairman, and CEO of Red Cell Partners and the co-founder and chairman of Zephyr. Welcome, Grant.
Thank you.
Zephyr AI. Okay. So, Ted, I want to start with you. You spent your career investing in startups, but Revolution is not solely a healthcare investment company. And in fact, Barry Beck is here from Blue Mercury. And who was your first investor? There you go. How good is that? See, it comes right around. And of course, all these other amazing companies, especially in DC, Kava, love Kava, Sweet Green. I love those guys. Georgetown, it always comes back to Georgetown. And Frame Bridge, just to name a few. Now, you've recently invested in Zephyr, which Grant co-founded, we talked about that, and Tempus, a Chicago-based early leader in the AI and precision medicine space. Tempus went public in a highly anticipated IPO this year. I have to read this because I want to make sure I get it right because you're changing everything. You were among the first institutional investors in the company and you sit on their board. So Ted, you could do anything. Why Zephyr AI?
Before we do that, I want you to know, why am I dressed like this?
You look good.
Yeah.
No. Because you're cool.
No, because I went to ChatGPT today.
Whoa.
And I said, I'm giving a speech in downtown DC with Grant.
Whoa.
In AI.
Oh, boy.
There'll be people from Meta. How should I dress?
Is this for real?
I swear. And I walked in. And I see Grant.
Yeah.
So it's good for something.
The shit works.
There you go.
What are you fancy looking for?
Well done.
It just works.
Well done.
So AI, I'm a bit older than Grant. I could probably be your dad, right?
I say that
my son the other day came to me and said, you've been like a father to me. So I was introduced to AI in 1978. I worked for a company called Wang Laboratories, my first job out of college. And MIT was doing really, really early work. And there was this unbelievably gifted man named Marvin Minsky, Dr. Minsky. And I contracted with him to come out and give a speech at Wang Laboratories. And he came in, he was a concert pianist. And he opened the show with playing the most beautiful concerto imaginable. And he said, I do this all the time to remind myself that when a machine can do that and emote the way I just did and got your attention, then we'll know that the machines have gotten there.
Wow, in 78.
In 78. Now, he died a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, under a cloud, somehow he was involved or implicated in some bad stuff, but he was a genius. But today, you can hear a concert, and it's better than how Marvin Minsky played. So we are rapidly getting to a point where we have to not only respect, but I would say embracing that it's more right than wrong. And the making fun of AI, I think it's way in the past, that it's real. And it's going to get into the hands, the enabling technology of three or four really, really big players. Someone said that you were with the people from NVIDIA. They're the most valuable company in the world. It's not Microsoft anymore. They're it. There's nothing that says this has arrived than Wall Street that says this is what we think is the most valuable company. We're not in that business. We're in the business now of how do we take those enabling technologies and verticalize them to be very, very specific to solve the biggest, most important human problems. And Tempus, I fell in love with, besides that I know the founder so well, we're pretty much best friends, and his wife got cancer. And he came to me and said, I'm gonna go find help for my wife. And it took him a year. He went to every great cancer clinic in the country and basically came back and said, I can plan my family vacation with more precision and with better information than going to the best cancer clinics all over the world. And when you ask that big question, if this was your wife and this was her diagnosis, what would you do? And the answers that he would get was, no, I think my partner had a case kind of similar to this a couple of years ago, or the New England Journal of Medicine had a 15-person trial. And Eric said, I'm going to fix that to the benefit of the patient and the doctor, because the doctor can't be happy with the tools that are being provided. So over the years, we invested $1 billion, and we've built the world's largest database of genomic and then related information, x-rays, blood type samples. We had to go to every one of these 100 leading cancer centers and digitize and clean and create and put into a very secure environment all of this data. We give it to the hospital, but we get it in the aggregate. And now, if Eric's wife were to go again, or someone like Eric's wife, they would say, we have 60 million records, and there are 88,000 women, just like your wife, who are of Russian descent, whose father had diabetes and whose mother had breast cancer previously, and this is their diet. And when they take this drug with this treatment and they adhere to it, they are still alive, and they're going on their eighth year. So we can recommend with precision that this is what you do. And the company took off. It's both sides of the equation. The patient, the doctors love it. But the pharmaceutical companies go, oh my goodness, we had no idea that in these use cases that our drug can prolong the life of the patient or improve the quality of life. They go and train their detail men to go to the hospitals to say, let us educate you now on the application. And the company really took off on its way to $1 billion in revenue, and it went public. It's got a $6-7 billion market cap right now.
Closer to eight.
$8 billion.
There you go.
And it's one of those investments where you go, we're helping families, we're helping husbands and wives to, you know, take control of their own prognosis and what can they do using this AI platform. And it's really helped the doctors. And from a business standpoint, obviously the pharmaceutical companies can't get into the data fast enough. So it's one of those great stories with happy endings all over the place.
That's incredible. I didn't know that. And that you got all the hospitals and everyone to work together to gather all that information. Actually, Grant, you should give the background how you ended up in this field. You got to go back to the high school story. Start there.
Sure. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and both my parents were in D.C. and the politic of D.C. And so from that, I got to experience the polarity of politics at my dinner table and wanted to get as far away from that as humanly possible. And so fell in love with science and medicine. Still don't know why, but somebody was having a bad day and gave me a shot, I guess. So I was fortunate enough to have a fellowship at the National Cancer Institute working at Building 10, which is bench to bedside research. So these are the sickest patients in the world, and they've effectively given up their lives to try to figure out how to, you know, bring the promise of precision medicine into practice. And I just fell in love. I mean, I was in high school and I was running around taking samples from a patient at the bedside, doing work and then bringing it into a lab. And I just thought that was the most incredible experience. And, you know, I can say some funny anecdotes, like that was my first like key card. And thinking like I was
Castle
in the
systems. It's
that's
always
right.
In the middle. Where am I?
Exactly. I went to go swipe it and I was like, I do that again, you know, because I'm an actual employee here now. I wasn't. I was in high school, didn't get a parking spot or anything like that. And so parked on the road outside of NIH and would count all my tickets and just,
that was your parents loved that.
A point of pride and fell in love and then was fortunate enough to do a paper in high school on how you could use one's immune system to attack cancer, but not the rest of your cells. And was fortunate enough, some way, shape, or form, to get published and did that as a senior in high school and went to Brown to focus on neurobiology and did a lot on computational biology and then dropped out of college after started my first company. I've had 19 surgeries on my right leg and sounds cliche, but when you go thinking you're going to go to play lacrosse and football in college, I did everything right, made all the right decisions and had a surgery that I thought was going to get me back to Brown. And turned out that the doctor said everything's been a wild success and everything's been great. And so I got excited and started to sit up in the hospital chair. And I was like, so when can I get back to my friends? I was a sophomore and wanted to get back to school. When do I get back to playing lacrosse? And he was walking out the door and he said, Grant, I don't know what to tell you, but you had this surgery so that we could get you back to walking and being pain-free, but you're never going to play sports again. While that might sound depressing, that was the greatest thing at the time that had happened to me, because if it wasn't for that, I would have never dropped out of college. I would have never been in this room, would have never met Ted, and among some other things. And so sounds cliche, but when you think you're going to go back and you did all of this to get back to playing sports, and this was all happening as Obamacare was happening, and there was all this debate around what was going to happen to the consumer in healthcare. This was after all of the electronic medical records sort of came and went. It was supposed to digitize everything, and then we sort of digitized nothing. And I just thought that that was a glaring hole in healthcare. And so dropped out of college, started my first company. We wanted to build the world's premier consumer digital health brand. And ultimately got to meet Ted, and he became a mentor and friend. We've been working together now for 14 years, and I'll never forget when we went and I pitched Ted and he passed. But
that was
but,
on Rally, not on Zephyr.
Exactly.
We don't believe in high school dropouts. Never going to make anything of yourself.
A lot of us talk about getting a mentor and what that might be and what, you know, all these amazing things that could come. And Ted's big thing was, hey, I'm not going to invest, but I will be your mentor. Ted got the short end of that stick.
Yeah.
But truly, if I did the math of like the dollars invested at the time versus the time that we've spent and the number of companies we've built together, and obviously Zephyr's an exciting one. We're doing a bunch of other things together. While that was this incredibly trying time and raising money for the first time, and for Ted to be so generous that he would say, hey, I'm not going to invest. This was an angel round, but I'll invest the time. And we built you know, friendship and relationship, and I owe a lot
of my success. You know, we invest in his companies.
I owe a lot of my success to Ted.
But there is true succession planning by a community, I think, is really important. I'm on the board of several public companies, and most important thing that you can do in sports, planning out what the lineup is going to be, how you're going to draft people, who goes off of the bench. We need to do that as a community. You mentioned Steve Case. I mean, a lot of things flowed out of AOL. And who's the next generation? And it was pretty obvious that Grant would be one of the leaders. Grant and his family stepped up and stood for standing pavilion at Georgetown Hospital. We needed that very much, right? So it was a proof point because we're aging out. It's not embarrassing to say that, you know, you get old quickly, and he's next generation. What you're doing here with the women's networking, and that's what we have to do. We have to find young people, help them to be successful, and teach them how to pass it on to keep it going, because the spiral's either going to go up or it's going to go down. There was no stasis in anything. So, you know, his next person up, if you will, and what Red Cell is trying to build as a platform company, Mario Marino did in the 90s, right? And so I'm going to get a building and put smart people in, venture capitalists and law firms and accounting firms, and try and build this hothouse. We did it at AOL. It was called The Greenhouse, where we would nest companies and give them money and give them traffic. A lot of great companies grew out of that, and that's what he's doing now. And Zephyr is one of his spin-out companies aimed at drug discovery, which makes a lot of sense because these big companies are not tech savvy. They might be chemistry savvy or biology savvy, but they don't know how to build. They don't know how to attract software engineers. And they all see that AI, especially if it gets at scale, the insights that it can bring to your scientists are breathtaking. And the cost of scale now with a lot of these companies, what's the cost a company to find a drug, bring the drug all the way through patent, get it through FDA, get it approved?
Back of the envelope is every drug, every molecule, 70% of the time fails. So 70% failure takes about a decade, and it's now roughly $2 million a day. So you could do the math, you know, somewhere between $500 million and $3 billion, and you're going to fail 70% of the time.
Now, when you hear a government elected official say, you charge too much for your drugs, that's true. But when you have a 70% failure rate and you're wasting $2 million a day, when you finally get a drug and it works, you have to be able to get that payback on that drug and also to cover the portfolio of failures. And so it's a very, very difficult business. The drug business is not a easy to manage business, and the regulatory environment atop of it is really, really difficult. AI, because it can comb through so much data, we both think there's a lot of drugs that didn't make it through FDA or they're lying dormant. They never reached their potential, where now you can go through, comb through a lot of different iterations. And if you can find, hey, if you added this ingredient or you worked with this treatment, it could pass FDA, or it would solve this other problem.
Right. Are you guys doing that? Do you have a company that does that?
I'll give an example specifically. Ted brought up a couple awesome things, but the really important things to mention on drug discovery is the reason why the pharmaceutical companies are most interested. They have a lot of data. They don't have data around people living in the wild using these. In this case, it's called next generation sequencing. And so what was pioneered at Tempus was, think of it as like breadcrumbs. You could take a blood test and Tempus could see if there's DNA from your tumor that has been shed and is existing somewhere in your blood. And what Tempus is able to do is with their test say, this is the amount of circulating tumor DNA. And what they're doing, which is incredible, which is why all these companies in the pharmaceutical space are so interested in Tempus, that data is allowing them to say, this RNA, DNA that's circulating in the blood, it does these things. And so now the value for a pharmaceutical company, if they have Tempus, they have patients in the wild. And when Ted said both sort of the diagnostic side and the drug discovery side, it's the combination of those two assets that are helping customers find new treatments. And that's where then Zephyr comes in. And a big part of what we're doing is using our AI to go and seek out the key signal that then this AI will seek in this sea of data. And so now you have all this data of all these patients in the wild, plus this next generation DNA sequencing in the blood. And so if you take those three sort of tectonic plates together, those massive shifts, the innovation that creates out of that is you have new drugs that could literally be incredible novel cures. But also to Ted's point, we might be using a drug that is wonderfully safe, but wasn't stunningly efficacious until we added that ingredient. And that's where really we together are trying to shift the promise, and it's been a promise because it hasn't been delivered yet, into practice for precision medicine.
Now in Washington, D.C., and someone will be in the room, listen to the podcast, and go, oh my God, safety, security, data integrity.
FDA.
Yes, of course, right? He mentioned the data. Well, adherence to prescriptions and treatments is one of the biggest issues that we face.
A multi-hundred-billion-dollar-a-year problem.
People don't take their drugs. So is the drug not effective, or is it that you're not taking the drug? But if you are taking the drug and you're getting it renewed all the time, what better way of saying the drug is working, they're still alive, they're still going and getting their prescription? And so we're trying to make sure the data integrity personalized is of utmost importance, but the ability to look in the aggregate at that data, and healthcare is what we spend most of our money on. It's truly amazing when you look at the costs, and as we live longer, it's the last years of life that are so expensive. And we're soon, as a economy and a country, we come to these decisions on what we don't want to save. Today, just on Twitter, I put up an obituary of my partner's mother, who died at 100 years old yesterday, 100 years old. And she was in very good shape. She was one of the lucky ones. But can you imagine having to make some decisions as a society on, well, we don't want to keep the person alive, right? We're going to face that. My grandchildren are going to live to be 110 years old. If you live over 100 years old, you are going to get cancer. There's a 100% chance that 100% of the population will get some kind of cancer. Well, there are treatments and medicines and new medicines that we'll find that will be able to extend your life even further. But the quality of life will then come into play. These are really, really big, important issues that we will have to wrestle as society, but at least it's on the side of the good angels, right? I feel no qualms about, you know, lives matter, and we should be doing everything that we can. And it should be our greatest export. We just did a Tempus, a big JV with Masa-san in Japan. He says, well, we won't have the size and the scale to be able to bring this to Japan. Let's do a joint venture. Teach us how to do this in Japan. Well, you can see this being exported, this technology, the data sets, on a worldwide basis. And the more data you get, this really will be a industry and business where the big will get bigger, the small will get marginalized. But guess what? Microsoft, Alphabet, Google, that's what's happened. If you get there big and fast, you get more precision. You get more access to the data. You get better insights. So that's what the race is going on now. Unlike the web that took 25 years, I mean, AOL was important for 12 years. Google's been important for 25 years now. Microsoft, 40 years. These companies are getting big and fast 5 years, 10 years. I mean, video really, I don't want to say came out of nowhere, but I'd say the last 3 or 4 years, it's been the greatest value creation. And, you know, they can't make enough.
What about OpenAI? Were you surprised by them? Were you surprised by ChatGPT, both of you?
Surprised?
Surprised the first time you used it, that things had moved that fast, that quickly.
No, I think it's going to be a self-evident thing. I mean, I've known Sam for a long, long time, and I've known Elon Musk for a long time. One of our partners in Monumental Sports is Jeff Skoll. He was the first CEO of eBay. He bought PayPal. We tried to buy PayPal at AOL. The solution was they'll go public so they can prove a market cap. And then eBay eventually bought them as a public company. And they became the way to get eBay traders to be able to accept payments back and forth. And Elon Musk was one of those people. Jeff went and started Participant Studios, became a maker of great movies. And he also got to invest in all of Elon's startups. And Elon was one of the prime movers in AI. And basically, ChatGPT has been what we've all been looking at. I mean, Google might look back and say, we blew it, because the natural extension on search, I could type in today on Google, what should I wear doing this? But the results were flat.
They weren't relevant to Ted versus Grant, and I want this at this time.
And it went through Instagram and showed he wears vests. This is what he looks like. Look at the watch he's wearing.
And look at the watch.
Look at the watch
oh my
I'm
God,
wearing.
That's so funny.
But this with rubber straps. I mean, like, truly.
No, I'm not kidding. I walked in and saw him, and I went,
nailed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because the question is, would you believe AI to tell you what you should be doing when your wife has stage 3 breast cancer?
That's what I wanted to ask you.
And what's interesting, though, is that doctor who said, I know it the old school way, et cetera, they will be practicing materially worse care because they don't have access to the wisdom of the crowd. I mean, what people don't realize, a couple of quick things, the amount of compute power on the iPhone that came out at the fall of 2007 had the same compute power as the Apollo mission to get to the moon. To keep that one metric, second metric in. And when you ask, like, are we surprised? I would imagine that both of us would say no. And this was a function of not really if, really it's a who and when in terms of who's going to be the winner with OpenAI. But the big piece on OpenAI was, and what Ted was talking about is a term that I want the folks here to remember, which is a large action model. So everyone has been discussing a large language model, and they're amazing, and the things they do are stunningly incredible. The difference between a large language model and a large action model is what Ted just said about his outfit. A large action model is pulling in things like the band and the material of his watch versus the color. And so a large action model is a large language model with countless different modalities of engagement. So it could be video, Instagram, just like Ted mentioned, and text. And so large action models, and they're just now being pioneered. Like, this is what we're building at Red Cell. And a big part of those large action models and having those different modalities of engagement is what will set the conditions for my doctor essentially using an AI-like product to make recommendations at that exact moment in time for my exact care based on my biology today. That's really where a large action model, I think as time goes on, will be the central figure in that oncologist role, not the physician.
Now, the unintended consequences of my knowing we're both going to be wearing cool kid watches with rubber bands are dramatic. So he was talking about the iPhone and the amount of power that's being used. The really cool kids, the deep science kids, they say, well, NVIDIA won, Intel is dead, right? In Intel, Moore's Law was the most important thesis of our time. And a lot of people say now, it's dead. It doesn't matter. It's over. That's why Intel is shrinking in value. NVIDIA can't make enough stuff. So in making the stuff with the power, it needs a lot of land. It needs a lot of space. I was in Richmond, Virginia with the governor a couple of months ago, and he said, oh yeah, Meta is taking miles of waterfront here and building data centers for AI.
I've got a great metric for electricity on that. So Virginia is the data center capital of the world. Ted and I are on the board.
We started, by the way.
I was going to say, why in Virginia? Oh, because of AOL.
AOL was the core. So AOL was there because of the core trunk lines and getting the core trunk lines. The physics was about the lag. So the further you were from those trunk lines, the more lag and the more required bandwidth you needed. So the closer that you were to those central nodes in Virginia, the better your performance was.
The first time I met Jeff Bezos, he drove down from New York. This hedge fund company came to AOL. And I said, Jeff, come in. Let's go outside. And we go to Waxpool Road, red light. Come here. You hear that? 80% of the world's internet traffic. Right under there. That's true.
Yep.
And it was because
where
of what...
Where is this, in Richmond?
No, Virginia. Well, but this was Northern Virginia. Yeah. Why do you think their biggest business, their cloud services business, their federal government cloud services business, and Amazon HQ2 is in Virginia? Because the first time he came, he said, this is where the internet was started.
So what I was going to say, so Ted and I started the Greater Washington Partnership with some other amazing people. And the whole concept was taking Richmond to Baltimore. It's the third largest economic zone in the country. And with Virginia being the data center capital of the world, one of the things to give you a sense of just how big this revolution is, and to Ted's point about the three things that matter most for AI right now are data to train your language models, compute in terms of the actual innovation required to run your models, and then power. And the interesting thing on all three of those, the longest pole in the tent is power right now. The state of Virginia peak power is about 28 terawatts of power. The current regulated proposals in hand, this isn't like on the come, it's coming, to go from 28, I think it's terawatts, but it could be gigawatts, but 28 terawatts, they have application before 2030 to add 50 terawatts of power. So that would mean a doubling of the current infrastructure for power just for data centers. So think about the entire state of Virginia only managing the power for data centers.
What are we having to do? Go into the water? There's all this work that's being done on the platform side. And we've chosen, let's harness all of that platform investment. Venture capitalists, major companies, Wall Street, the government, for healthcare. Because it's where the money is spent, it's where the lives are lost, it's where we can have the most input. I just made an investment in a company, and you know what? If you're interested in this, because healthcare is so important, it's called Proxy Foods. And some of Grant's investors have come in to invest.
And so it's Grant.
And Grant's coming in.
Also, thanks to Ted.
Because big food companies are challenged because they're poisoning the world. And they all want to look at plant-based alternatives. So if you're Mars, that's headquartered here, if you're Nestle's, headquartered here, you don't have the ability to bring in great AI software developers. You don't have the ability to go out and get lots of data. And our taste buds are genetically driven. So just like Tempest will go and get the genetic information for people related to your cancer, we're going out and we're trying to capture why people taste, smell, the texture differently. also animals, pets. You ever hear in marketing the dogs didn't eat the dog food? Well, in taste tests, the dogs can't say, well, I like the way it tasted,
right,
but the smell,
Right.
So we are basically creating a database for recipes so that we can say to a company, well, Ted's Mediterranean, and he grew up on feta cheese, but he's lactose intolerant. And eventually he stops eating feta cheese. But there was these two white beans with this kind of seasoning and olive oil. When mixed together, people like Ted think it tastes, smells, and the texture is just like feta cheese. And that's what the world will go to. So if you're a dog pet food company, you're a massive food company making plant-based alternatives, well, that'll save the planet a lot. These big food companies, they won't pay enough to be able to say, oh, you mean I can replace this bad ingredient with this plant-based ingredient, many times save money and be able to market it to young consumers who want to eat the right way. That is a big part of the ecosystem. Your diet drives a lot on, are you going to get cancer?
A perfect example, just to bring that home, when you look at COVID, if you actually look at the split-adjusted demographic differences, in particular, COVID was more fatal to, in particular, men of Hispanic and African or African-American origin. When you did the analysis on the underlying data, in particular on the diabetes and the complications associated with like pulmonary and how you breathe and how efficiently, much of what we found was Latino food and the way that Latino American families eat food has an enormously high salt and enormously high sugar content. When you split adjust by the CDC, you can see a statistically significant increase in fatalities associated with COVID was linked to diet. And so to Ted's point, you don't think very often that AI is going to revolutionize how you can come up with the right food, and coming up with a plant alternative for feta is a kernel today, but that AI that is now running the analysis on all of those recipes and then comparing that data with how a patient is responding to a chemo agent. Now this is where AI is able to take the data and be able to go and reach out and say across all those recipes, show me the recipes that give you a statistically higher progression-free survival when combined with Tagrisso from AstraZeneca.
And those data sets one day would be combined, and we'd be able to say people from a young age who eat this way and have replaced bad food with this kind of food, this is how their survivability was much greater. The case that you just brought up on COVID, it was self-evident. It was the propensity for people to die of COVID that were African-American and Hispanic, and that we were surprised at it, right? And we should have been able to get in front of that to be able to predict, hey, this disease attacks this part of your immune system. These are the people that will be most prone. They're the ones who we should have been protecting and injecting quickest. And so, you know, we're at the first inning of all of this, and we have to be open to the solutions that will come, but we also have to be vigilant because there's going to be some bad actors. There's going to be bad things that are happening.
Well, this is one of the things I wanted to ask, but how do you have trust? When we talk about privacy, I don't want to really get into privacy, but I think the bigger issue is trust, because if people don't believe it, and if you don't incorporate the doctors, I hear what you're saying about the numbers and all that, but don't you need doctors and new medical professionals to come in and say, wait, this is working? I mean, are you going to go like one hospital at a time? To your point, Johns Hopkins University, You know, those researchers have all been there a long time. You can name any place. And now you're saying, look at these numbers. How do you have the public's trust through all of this? Big opportunity to have a longer, healthier, happier life.
I've been married 38 years.
Yeah.
And my wife is really beautiful, really powerful. And she said to me when we were courting, if I don't trust you, I can't love you. People who have worked for me, portfolio companies, I say, look, at the heart of a brand, of a business, has to be trust. Because they don't trust you, they won't love you. Now, trust gets broken, and you can repair it. But in this world that we live in, sometimes little things that break, they get covered, and the media has to play a big role in that. There's no company that hasn't been broken into via cyber attack. The greatest companies, I'm on the board of American Express. It is the greatest company. It has thousands and thousands of people. It's a couple of hundred years old. All we do is make sure that our consumers know that we have their back. But we have thousands of partners. And when a partner gets hacked, and I've used my American Express card at Neiman Marcus to buy a Christmas gift for my wife, and then Neiman Marcus gets hacked, it comes back to American Express. It's all a part of the ecosystem. So we're going to need maturity, if you will, on shit happens sometimes, and we all have to be grown-ups about how we're going to architect this next thing. If we try to kill AI, I mean, someone just got the Nobel Prize, and he was on 60 Minutes. He's a genius, and it was wonderful TV, and I'm sure it was edited to get the drama, and everyone in the media wants it to be. Can it code and write and think itself? That's because if it does, it'll have evil intentions, and it'll seek to control us. So we shouldn't do it? Is that what we're saying? We have to have guardrails. We have to have safeguards. We have to have regulations. But don't you want to save lives? Don't you want to extend the quality of life? That's what we want to do. If we do that with fidelity, we're going to make a lot of money. This isn't the web where it's an e-commerce app for avocado sandwiches, right? That right. For millennials in downtown DC. These are big, big questions that we can answer. Now, for the government and the military, everyone's scared to death. I mean, a computer can decide via simulation when we should attack. And I go, yeah, that would be terrible. What do you think's going on in the Middle East right now? Maybe we would be better off if there was a simulation going on that says, no, you shouldn't be sending 180 ballistic missiles. But we don't have that. It's not art and science. Right now, it's basically emotion. And so I think there's a lot of goodness here. On the trust side, we don't trust anyone in politics. My fear is because we don't trust anyone in politics, how can anyone say, I'm advocating for this next generation technology? Everyone is going to try and get votes to say, this is bad. Trust in me, I'll stop it. That's the worst thing that could happen to society. We need to move forward, but we need to be able to have the guardrails. And I don't know how to gain the trust, but I know if Washington, D.C. wants to play a central role in this, it's got to chill a little bit. I mean, I hope we get through this election and then things can get a little bit more sane on the go forward because, you know, half the country doesn't trust the other half of the country in any way. And AI is something that there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of thought that has to go into it. And I'm afraid that like 60 Minutes is going to get painted you know, Oprah is interviewing Sam Altman.
Oh, yeah.
Can Oprah. I trust you, Sam?
Oh, yeah. Right? I just thought, yeah, she leaned forward. Yeah. Although at the Washington AI Network, we're like, Oprah, you're late to the game. We've been doing this for a year. Grant, can we trust you? Yeah. If you guys haven't seen it, you really should see the special because the FBI director was also on. Yeah.
I hadn't had a chance to see it, but it's a perfect example for what Ted's painting. A couple really important parallels to Ted's point about having people in DC controlling this. The parallels that I've drawn in a number of places, there were about 1,000 graduate level physicists in 1900. By 1938, nuclear fission is invented and discovered in Berlin. And then by 1942, 600,000 of the greatest minds in the world were gathered to create the Manhattan Project. And much of that was a race to create a technology when we were worried about Hitler and his view for a 1,000-year Reich. And if he got this nuclear weapon, then what would happen to the world? But that forcing function created an incredible amount of knock-on effects. And the parallels I see are incredible between the Manhattan Project and AI. And the best example is we stood up all these national labs as part of the Manhattan Project to enrich nuclear fissile material. Today, those national labs are the premier innovating technology on the intersection between supercomputing and GPU and next generation large language and large action models. The Enigma machine, which was sort of one of the first computers, it was the code machine that the Nazis had that had about 16 quintillion permutations. And the view was you won't be able to break the code because it's 16 quintillion permutations. The publicly acknowledged supercomputer, right when COVID kicked off in 2020, that the NSA has is, again, this is several years ago, and this is the public unclassified version is doing 16 to 20 quintillion permutations per second.
Yeah. And you know, we talked about Oppenheimer and, you know, nuclear power was demonized. And the cool kids, the smart kids, there's a great movie, actually Jeff Skoll helped to make it, called Nuclear Now. You can watch it on Netflix. And it basically shows, had we continued to allow nuclear power in partnership with government to make sure that, you know, it wasn't going to melt down through the core of the earth, Michael Douglas, you know, wins an Oscar, right? And but now nuclear power, everyone goes, it's clean, it's safe, it gets rid of oil. I mean, all the things that we're talking about, but we lost 30 years of development. GE was the largest manufacturer of nuclear power plants. And 30 years ago, they shut down that operation. It became a below-the-line endeavor. They said, this is poison to our business and Wall Street. Why? Because the media said, this is a really, really bad thing. Now, in hindsight, that was a really bad call. And we need nuclear power as a part of the tapestry of all of the way that we're going to generate energy for the 8 billion people. You know, another thing that's really fascinating is North America, United States, we have 350 million people. I came to Washington, D.C., started my first business, Georgetown University, the bicentennial summer, 1976. I sold snow cones, red, white, and blue snow cones. Eat a Patriot, give your tongue a sleigh ride, introduce variable pricing if it was 90 degrees or below 50 cents. I was innovating early on. But there were 250 million people in the country, 200 years old. Now there's 350 million people. That's pretty good. There's 8 billion people on the planet. Again, there was all this, how are we going to survive? How are we going to use the planet and care when we get to 10 billion people? Now there's math that says we're not going to get to 10 billion people. Okay? If you're not growing, you're shrinking. A shrinking planet, stasis is not a good thing. we're a very, very small country. We might be the most powerful country right now, but when we're talking about AI and scale, why do you think China has embraced this? They go, oh, we got scale. We got 20,000 math PhDs a year. They got 2,000 math PhDs a year. Let's push as hard as we can. Now, they're not as creative yet, but boy, China's thrilled that AI is on the horizon because they think, oh, this is something we can get bigger, faster, and better. And they're not shy about control, and they don't worry about issues like trust and what's the media going to say.
Exactly.
We're really could be disadvantaged because of our democracy. And we're not going to throw away democracy, but we have to have our eyes open. We're small potatoes around the world. And we have to have a growth mindset. We have to have allies. We just as we have to bring in data into our networks, the United States is going to have to pick its partners, if you will, to be a part of this. Go in space exploration. It's truly amazing that the United States has to outsource to Elon Musk to go rescue people stranded in the space station. And we have to have space exploration. That's how we're going to get a lot of data. That's how, for the next generations, how we're going to escape the planet. Well, there are people, gratefully, that are having these big thoughts. Jeff Bezos, that's what he's thinking about. Elon Musk, that's what he's thinking about. And it's for the betterment of everybody, right? We're not talking about we're only going to send people from Seattle to Mars, right? Yeah. It's what are we going to do on mankind? Well, AI gives us the power, the opportunity to have those big thoughts. I reached out to you. I never reach out to speak.
I almost fell over. I called 50% of the people in this room. I just got an email for Ted Leonsis.
Because it's so needed. And, you know, when we first at AOL, you know, we got people out on the web, we'd go to the Senate, we'd go to Congress, and they didn't have computers in their office. We would bring a computer to show them this is how you get online. This is what we mean on getting online. That's what's going to happen now with AI. You're going to have, you know, people holding extended hearings, and they're illiterate in the algorithms. They're illiterate in the science of what this means. And so, you know, we need younger Washington. We need people that become evangelists, if you will, for it, but with the warnings, right? We can have little warning. You can buy a pack of cigarettes, that's a little warning on the side, right? We know how to do that. But DC really has a lot of power to make this blossom in the right way or to stop it, and they'll declare victory, and then China will win. And we'll win a battle, but we'll lose like the biggest, most important war.
That's where really on AI, the transition of 1,000 graduate level PhD students to nuclear fission being discovered in 38 years, that is not what's going to happen with AI. It's moving like that. And I think it'll be measured in years. I mean, OpenAI, from the time it launched to passing the Turing test, which is the ability to basically fool somebody that it's not a computer, it's a person, that was done in years, not decades. And that was before they were the most valued and, well, one of the most valued, but one of the most well-funded startups in history. And so this $6 billion that they just raised, it is a function of scale. And the problem with AI is it is, to much Ted said earlier, about the big will get bigger. And AI is the most asymmetric weapon, technology, opportunity. And we all have to remember that China is a fundamental economic competitor and great power competitor to us. We never were worried about the economic model of the Soviet Union breaking capitalism. But there's a model where China's model with AI is fundamentally different in its ability to compete than what the open capitalist model is. And with BRICS and a number of things they're doing, to Ted's point, we have the opportunity for AI to blossom. Or if we stifle it, it's not going to go away like nuclear did. Somebody else will have that power and wield it. And we have to make sure the next 100 years continue as the next great American century. And that'll come back to AI.
Yeah, we do. I want to thank you guys so much for being here, the work you're doing, the lives that you're really going to save. I just can't tell you how much we appreciate your time. And keep us posted on how everything is going. Let's hear it again for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.